Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings with Just Another Christmas Song from It's a Holiday Soul Party. We heard Luscious Jackson and Queen of Bliss from a collection called O Come All Ye Faithful, Rock for Choice on the Columbia Records label. August Darnell did Christmas on Riverside Drive, and that set started with James Brown and Go Power at Christmas Time from Santa's Got a Brand New Bag. I like how he just kind of starts chatting about his film ski party in there. And I know I say this every Christmas, but go watch the James Brown scene from the film Ski Party. I haven't seen the full film, so I can't really recommend it, but I can recommend James Brown's scene from Ski Party. My name is Therese. I've been filling in for Scott Williams today. Here on WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. I believe that Scott will be back next week. Scotty, I hope you're feeling better. Coming up in just a couple minutes will be Stu and Sarah filling in for Tectonic with Mark Hurst. Let's go out with this Vince Guaraldi trio from A Charlie Brown Christmas. And I'll see you soon. Happy holidays. Stay safe, stay warm, be kind. And we'll all get through this together. Hello, everybody. It's Sarah and Stu from Games People Play here for Mark Hurst.
And Tectonic.
And Tectonic. How are you doing, Stu?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm doing well. What would you... I think I'm going to have you introduce today's subject and guest, if you don't mind, just because you're the biggest fan I know of the guy.
Yeah, well, there you go. You know, we thought that, you know, with the proximity of the holidays and all, that we'd try and find an uplifting thing to talk about that intersects with tech. And the best that we could come up with was ghosts.
I love ghosts.
I love ghosts too, but sort of, it starts with, you know, the death part. So not exactly uplifting.
Well, I mean, listen, wintertime, it's about death.
It's a liminal period.
I mean, it's
you
a
know,
liminal
the solstice,
period.
The darkness, the
death
cold.
Is a part of life.
It's true.
It's something we're all going to do.
It's a cycle.
Not to stress anyone out, if that's a thing.
See, but, yeah, this is us being uplifting.
Yeah, this is us being uplifting.
So, I've been... The Brits are very into ghost stories at Christmas, which is why I naturally was just like, oh, it's a Christmas episode.
It's Christmas time.
We can...
Here on the radio.
Yeah.
And everywhere.
And they've made a big thing about ghosts for about almost 200 years, starting with... sort of Charles Dickens and the Christmas Carol. It's a thing. It's an obsession. A tradition. They had a TV show in the 70s, periodic. They have a whole bunch of extremely not Christmassy specials they're basically horror movies that premiere on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day in the 70s that are incredibly good, but incredibly not Christmassy. Some of which just scared the pants off of people.
I mean, you and I are both big Halloween heads. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't mind being ghosty at Christmas, you know? I'll be ghosty anytime. Halloween is all year, if you believe it in your heart.
My wife, Daisy, is very much like, why are you watching all of these spooky things? Halloween was 2 months ago. And I was like, ghost stories at Christmas.
And it wasn't long enough, okay? That's the problem.
But, the ghost stories at Christmas was just something that I've been watching them. I've been reading them. There's this great British Library has an anthology series called Tales of the Weird. They have 4 volumes of Christmas set ghost stories that I've been reading this month. I just have it on the brain.
Very cool. And when were those published?
Anywhere from 1850 to the modern era.
Oh, nice. So a real history of ghosts.
Right. And I think that in terms of the fiction, these are ghost story, it's fiction, it's horror fiction.
Sure.
These were coming out at a time when there was great technological advances, and I think they reflect a certain amount of anxiety over that technology. And we're used to this with science fiction, right? Like there's the famous
right.
tweet with or whatever it is, the Torment Nexus, where like the science fiction writer writes about the Torment Nexus. He's like, don't do this. And the tech
and
bro is like, yes,
it.
Let's do that.
Let's do that. Yeah.
And we're used
Which
to,
is, by the way, we're, that's the period we're living through now,
right, yes.
I believe. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just checking.
And, we're used to that with science fiction. But I think with ghost stories, it was sort of interesting to me. There's so many of these British ones are obsessed with trains. And it's just like I don't think of books as technology. I also kind of don't think of trains as technology
but they are.
Anymore.
I mean, or they can be, I
and
guess.
During this period, like the when after A Christmas Carol was written, trains were really remaking the face of England.
Right.
So it was something that was really on people's minds. And Dickens himself wrote a horror story called The Signalman, which is about a train conductor who's kind of getting these premonitions about a crash, and he's trying to like stop the crash. But it, really, it's just the crash that kills him that he's been having premonitions of. It's really grim.
And no one else dies, or do other people die?
I think there are a couple
other casualties.
So much. Well, wow. and it was inspired by Dickens surviving a really terrible train
it was a
accident.
Trauma. Yeah. Okay.
So like, there's a direct relationship.
Trauma response.
There.
Yeah.
And then also at the same time, you know, towards the end of the 1800s, you have the spiritualist movement come about, right? And they're,
right.
they're all talking about they're making a literal religion out of sort of interfacing with ghosts and taking photographs, which is also another type of technology.
Right. And they also had they created new technologies to sort of measure and, check whether or not a real ghostly occurrence was happening in the room, or if I think they also tried to see if the spiritualists themselves were actively doing anything, and they would X-ray them and so,
yeah, you
so
had
forth.
Both sides, right?
Yeah.
The believers were cooking up technological ways to measure
to prove there's a ghost
yeah,
here,
this
and
contact
the skeptics
with the
were saying, "No, this person is a charlatan,"
right? And using their own half-baked pseudoscience,
right, to prove that. Right, and everyone's just making up strange, usually electromagnetic devices, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And yeah, and I think that if you look at the spiritualist movement, you see a lot of, again, it's just a massive amount of social and technological change going on, and it was just a grasping for something spiritual amongst all of this like industrialization. And it's interesting that you mentioned electromagnetism, because.
Well, we did just interview this person who knows a lot about it, so I learned a lot. I'm kind of spoiling. I'm like, and here's me pretending like I know everything.
Well,
when
no,
really I just talked to Adam.
We're setting it up.
We're doing, of course.
We're building a bed. a little bedrock. I mentioned that there were a bunch of movies or teleplays in England in the 70s. One of them is The Stone Tape. And it's sort of interesting because it's. The idea is that a bunch of scientists go to this castle because they're holing up to try and find a new recording medium. So it's the 70s. You have tape and you have vinyl. So think of it as them trying to research, get a technological breakthrough.
CDs.
Yeah. Yeah. What they find, though, in this castle is that it's haunted, and this incident replays over and over and over again. And they figure out that it is an electromagnetic kind of recording of the event that's held in the stones of the foundation, and they investigate this, and it becomes a moral about science and the limits of it, because they're sort of duped into repeating the cycle, and you know, one of the researchers dies and becomes the new ghost, and they realize that there's multiple layers of this recording, and there's something unearthly, unhuman at the root that's impossibly ancient that science can't measure nor reckon with.
Cosmic horror.
Right.
Yeah.
And but, you know, it's amidst this technological, you know, trappings where it's literally, I mean, there's probably like a nuclear armaments thing kind
Absolutely.
Of going. There's a bunch possible things, but there's definitely like an anxiety about tech.
And something that I think is interesting is when there is anxiety, when people have anxiety, we do all these things to sort of self-soothe by, say, you know, making up a contraption that measures whatever we think it's measuring. And then we tell ourselves a story of like, well, I'm safe because this reading isn't happening, even though you're probably doing absolutely nothing.
Right.
And I think that's sort of both a really endearing quality of humans and also one of the most frustrating things that we have to deal with this crank science stuff.
Yeah, and right? That's also part of the appeal of ghost stories at Christmas.
Right.
You know, it's the idea of we are gathered together at a moment in time when usually the weather's kind of crummy, but we're having a good time.
It's cold, it's dark.
But we're safe together.
But we're here in the place that it's warm together.
So we can tell this scary story and be scared together where it's safe.
Yeah.
And we don't have to worry about the repercussions. And we feel better about stuff like our anxieties over the telephone or the
or electric, trains
yeah, or trains or
Which
whatever
are...
Or AI or
ugh, God.
So this week we decided I wanted to talk to Adam Allsuch Boardman, who is an author and illustrator. He's written four books, one about film, which we're not going to talk about, and three about the unexplained, which are an illustrated history of ghosts, an illustrated history of UFOs, and an illustrated history of urban legends. And we wanted to talk to him about the sort of the intersection of tech anxieties, ghosts, the unexplained, and all of this, and see what his take on it all was.
Right, and we're just about to get into part one of our interview with Adam. I did just want to briefly mention we opened the interview letting Adam speak about his art, which was a very conscious choice on our part to let an artist talk about his art in this age of AI being used so often, or thinking it can be used, people thinking it can be used so often to replace an artist's work, which is just not true.
Yeah. So, and his art is fantastic.
His art is fantastic.
And I also screw up the names of the books in the beginning.
Just
of the
one.
Just the one.
You say an illustrated history of cryptids when you meant
Mothman's on the cover, so it's an honest
mistake.
It was
an honest mistake. And he didn't correct you because he's a gentleman.
Yes.
So without further ado.
Why don't you tell us, Adam, a little bit about your work and how you came to do these books, An Illustrated History of Ghosts, An Illustrated History of UFOs, and An Illustrated History of Cryptids.
Those are some long titles. Yes. I'm an illustrator. I've been working as an illustrator for 10 years or so, as of this November, actually. So that's an exciting anniversary. My first book, my first foray into publishing, was An Illustrated History of Filmmaking. And once I'd finished that book, the publishers asked if I had any other interests. And as a lifelong X-Files fan, I suggested UFOs. And from then on, this publisher has been very interested in my paranormal or metaphysical or supernatural interests. But the rest of the time, I'm a regular commercial artist. I work on board games, other STEM type books, publishing, editorial, sort of NDA commercial stuff, all sorts of things.
I just want to sort of start with a little bit of your style. I find it extremely appealing and engaging. It's very sort of information rich, but still sort of, and by that I mean sort of like graphical and clean, but it also still manages to convey a lot of emotion and atmosphere. And I was just sort of wondering how you sort of developed that style.
Well, I'm glad you think it's clear and approachable, because that's very much my intent. You know, I started out, my very first work as an illustrator was for museum design agencies. So it was the sort of illustrated panels that would go alongside exhibits. And from then on, it's always been what I pushed for was clear imagery that still had a good amount of detail, that was appealing to a broad audience. But, you know, my influences range from Tintin to IKEA instructions. You know, I like clean lines, limited palette, that kind of thing.
One of the things that I found super interesting about the ghost book is that you are managed to make images spooky without you indulging in sort of the tropes of you know, what you would expect from ghostly visuals. Like I said, you're very clear. It's very sort of brightly lit, and it's interesting to me to see you kind of cut against that in your art for the supernatural.
It's a difficult brief to draw frightening images when much of your audience is going to be children. So I didn't want the images to be too frightening or grotesque. So a lot of the compositions are about creating a liminal space, or it's about what you don't see, perhaps. You know, the vacancy of detail in certain spaces, or the extreme shadows, but without going into the arena of the grotesque. I guess it's gothic horror rather than shock horror.
Yeah,
this shock horror is a term.
There is sort of an imminence, I feel like, in a lot of your work. The the one of the Japanese tunnel. You know, it's just a car outside of a tunnel, but you could sense that something's about to happen. And I think that's really appealing.
I think, yeah, that's the intent, is what's happening just off the page. It leaves it to the viewer to imagine. I recently watched, in the run-up to Halloween, the 1960s film The Innocents, starring Deborah Kerr. And they used a really wide lens, which was unusual for the horror genre. But because of this, the scenery is full of vacant space. So you have lots of detail in the foreground and the background and lots of empty space. And that's where you the viewer, populate with ghosts. You know, you're imagining shadows moving around, etc. And that kind of thing is very current now in horror, you know, to the Haunting of Hill House, etc. The Haunting of Bly Manor, you know, uses the same tricks.
So you're British, and the ghost story has a sort of, you know, it's a universal thing. Ghosts, the belief in ghosts and the manifestation of the afterlife is a human universal. But I think that the British have a preoccupation with ghost stories, specifically ghost stories for Christmas. And I was wondering if you could comment on that before we get into the meat of the rest of the episode.
Well, going back thousands of years in pagan beliefs, this part of the year was kind of reflecting upon death, all the way from what we now call Halloween to the New Year period. It's winter, it's when all the plants have died back. You're relying on what you've gathered over the harvest. So there were many festivals this time of year throughout Europe dwelling on death, and a lot of these endured to modern times, and we particularly associate it with the Victorian era and the turn of the century because of people like Charles Dickens, who wrote, as we all know, A Christmas Carol, and M.R. James, who wrote a great many ghost stories, and he would tell them every year at his little ghost club of meetings. And he's probably most famous for stories like Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad. Well, that's not the name of the story. It's, what's that one called? But that's the line from the story, which has been adapted a few times. M.R. James and Charles Dickens really cemented the ghost story as a sort of Christmas tradition, which has endured on TV now. Mark Gatiss has adapted a few M.R. James stories. It's just part of the spooky wintertime culture. It's cold outside. We gather around and tell stories.
It's sort of the ultimate of the idea of the shared scary story. You're safe inside with friends, so you can't, nothing bad could happen, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So when I was reading, we're going to go out of order. I know that UFOs was written first, but chronologically, and I read them this way, but An Illustrated History of Ghosts, I was struck by, and it's sort of one of those things that seems obvious in hindsight, but you get into the idea that spiritualism was a sort of religion based around ghosts, the afterlife, making contact with deceased relatives. I never really connected that with the ghost story or ghost lore as I enjoyed it as a kid. But they're, you know, it's obviously they're interested in the same things. Could you walk us through that?
Sure. Attitude towards ghosts is changeable across times and cultures, you know, going way back as far as you possibly can to ancient Mesopotamia. You know, belief in ghosts was universal. Everyone believed in ghosts, as far as we know. They were pitiable lost souls that needed to be placated by ritual. You know, it was sad if you saw a ghost. You know, it needed to be resolved. The 19th century, there was a lot of unrest, war, and the introduction of things like photography made hoaxing ghosts a bit more tangible. You know, those connected artifacts to the supernatural. You could go to a studio, have a portrait taken and behind you, you might see a deceased ancestor or a loved one. So that's one instance where technology starts to enter the equation. But spiritualism as a sort of religion rose up in the mid to late 19th century, carried on, got exported to Europe and then re-exported to the US. It was unusual, and it connected to long-standing beliefs within the occult. It's unusual how all these things link up, let's say.
Mm. And there is sort of a direct reaction, just not just to the ongoing wars, but also just the ongoing industrialization of the world, right? There's spiritualism's looking for more of a spiritual meaning to an increasingly unspiritual world, right?
Yeah, I think it's a search for the spiritual that can be recorded. And that's where you get the ghost hunters and their various guises, and the spirit mediums, and the parapsychologists, and the psychical researchers. It's something that needs to be quantified with technological tools like cameras or x-rays. X-rays were used to scrutinize spirit mediums to see where they were hiding their ectoplasm, for instance. Graphite was used to look for fingerprints, to search out fakery. There was a guy in France, Eugene Osti, who used an infrared beam targeted at a spirit medium to try and see them moving in the dark. And, there was groups that would bring spirit mediums into the lab setting to scrutinize them, which didn't always produce interesting results. I think that was the main change, was the drive to find evidence, whereas that hadn't been there hadn't been a need for that previously, or it became an increasing need to find evidence.
Do you think that photography was the overriding technological advancement that sort of like spurred this on?
Oh yeah, easily. Yeah, it was from the mid 19th century. It was increasingly familiar to people, and perhaps the prevalence of the technology outpaced the understanding of how it worked, which we still see today. People will fall for clickbait all the time, and people will still use photography now to evidence the supernatural, pictures of Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster. But yeah, photography has definitely had a huge, huge role to play in both ghosts and UFOs, and these things can be easily manipulated.
It was interesting you say photography is still used now to sort of prove the existence of the supernatural or ghosts, and it made me think of a ghost tour I took in New Orleans. And, everyone has a phone now, and the guide was very encouraging to have us take pictures down dark alleyways.
Yes.
And whatnot. But I remember him really emphasizing that, like, don't be afraid to take it quick. And it was sort of the way that he was making us all move our phones around as we were taking the photos, so that we'd end up with weird, light patterns or whatever. And also just the group think of it. We kept showing each other the pictures we were taking as we were taking them. Like, what's this? Oh, no. And it's sort of interesting how the technology itself made it almost a prop in the storytelling of
that's
these
right.
New Orleans ghosts. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. You would have easily produced orbs or artifacts, in a dark place with a camera phone. You're going to pick up all sorts of particles in the air that will look interesting. And as you say, the technology plays a role in the experience. I wonder if that ghost walk would have been as fun without the phones.
Yeah, I mean, it was almost a bit of hysteria in a way, in a fun way. And we all kind of were self-aware about it. But, fake it till you make it. You start scaring yourself and then everyone's scared. And it was really fun. And we were all a little drunk. I'm not going to lie about that. But
well, that helps.
Yeah, it does.
I do think it's interesting that there's sort of like a subversion of technology in that way, where you're using a cell phone in a way that is sort of knowingly going to produce interesting effects. But also this creation of oddball crank science to also track these things. Like using, you know, infrared or things like that in a way to sort of produce evidence rather than to kind of gather scientific data, right?
Yeah, ghost hunters will use anything from thermometers to EMF, which is electromagnetic field. They'll use meters to measure that, infrared cameras, carbon monoxide detectors, sound recorders. And all of those can produce anomalous results because they're not designed to record ghosts, you know. A believer will accept sometimes that as evidence, but a skeptic will say that, you know, an EMF meter isn't specifically designed to pick up sensitive evidence of a ghost. It's to find wiring in a wall, you know.
Right. And it's presenting the appearance of science rather than the trappings of science to sort of to convince.
Yes. A skeptic will be able to use some tools to rule out things at the very least, but it won't often be used to prove the existence of a ghost. You know, I've talked to skeptic ghost hunters who will use things like a carbon monoxide detector to rule out carbon monoxide as a factor, something that could be causing distress or hallucinations or some kind of health risk, you know, that might provide an explanation, a rational explanation.
And I love the idea of just the EMF detector as like a tool for detecting ghosts based on what exactly? Why have we decided that ghosts are scientifically a magnetic or electromagnetic phenomenon? You know, like it's sort of they've reached into the dark to try and find anything that they could kind of use to get sort of any kind of result to work off of. I just think that's interesting. And I mean, that probably comes directly from, you know, the Stone Tape and the earlier stuff about the idea of ghosts being repeated phenomenon recorded in the environment.
I love Stone Tape, and I spent ages trying to find the provenance of the term beyond the BBC series of the same name. But I guess as we develop more and more tools to measure the world around us, we come up with more dark corners for ghosts to hide in, if that makes sense.
Well, I feel more Christmassy.
Do you really?
I don't know about you. Hmm. Yeah, sure.
Is it just the British accent?
It's mostly the British accent, yeah.
He just sounds so intelligent.
I mean, he is intelligent.
I mean, yeah,
it's not, but it helps that he's got the flavor.
I mean,
well,
my Jersey accent isn't adding anything.
You sound smart too. Come on.
But so as I mentioned, Adam has written a number of books.
Not just on ghosts.
Yeah, he's also written one on UFOs.
Yeah, which will be the subject of our part two.
Yes.
And it's a little bit longer because I think maybe he hit a particularly viable nerd vein in both Stu and I.
Yes.
So do you want to introduce the break, the song break?
Oh, yeah. So I couldn't think of anything that screamed ghosts more than 1980s, one of the greatest 1980s bands, new wave bands, A Flock of Seagulls. I mean, they're synonymous, right?
Well, you know, if A Flock of Seagulls attacks you.
You could be a ghost.
I mean, it's not like a ghost, but it's very scary. Mm. So.
But we're going to play Messages, which if you listen closely, they're looking for messages. They're trying to pick up messages from the empty sky.
Quite thematic.
And yeah, it feels very a good pivot point for our little conversation with Mr. Boardman.
Beautifully said, Stu.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Awesome.
The messages, you can't really hear him say it distinctly, but he's saying that the messages are coming from the rings of Saturn, which I don't know that the significance of, but it seems UFO-y.
That seems very alien-ish. Mm. Yeah, at least. Maybe they don't have vehicles yet, but yeah. They're sending messages across the sky.
Yeah.
Do you want to, I mean, actually, that's a pretty good setup.
Yeah, there you go.
For the next part of our interview with Adam Alsich Boardman, who did a book on ghosts and UFOs.
All right, so I'm going to come back in on UFOs. I'm going to ask you something brilliant about UFOs as soon as I think of it.
Oh, yeah? I'm excited.
Oh, yeah? Okay, we're waiting.
Are they real? Is that a question? Have you seen one?
Actually, that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Adam, have you ever seen a UFO?
Have I seen a UFO? I've certainly seen strange lights above a place called Ilkley Moor. And that's about as interesting as it gets. Very distant, moving lights in the sky. And they could be easily explained as lanterns, lit lanterns that have been set off by somebody. But because I couldn't confirm what it was, it remains an unknown, and I accept that.
Were you a kid or were you an adult?
I was an adult. This was maybe 3 years ago.
Oh, okay. I saw a, when I was a kid, I had the Usborne All About or the World of UFOs book, and there's a little thing in there that, like, a form that you fill out if you see one. And of course, I saw one that looking back, and I filled it out in the actual book. And looking back, it's clearly an airplane that was flying in an established air route behind my house. It's just such a, I look back on that. I'm just like, wow, I really convinced myself that I saw a UFO that was clearly, unequivocally, an airplane.
Well, how about this? Since we're all sharing our kid UFO stories, I too, like Adam, was a huge X-Files fan. And I don't know how old you are, Adam, but I was about 10 when the show premiered. And so I was, you know, watching the sky all the time. And I remember looking out of my bedroom window and seeing in the distance three lights, not connected to each other per se, but moving in erratic patterns, and fully convincing myself that I was seeing alien spacecraft before realizing, thankfully, at the time, that it was just three moths flying underneath a streetlight.
Oh my goodness.
Oh, beautiful.
And, but it was just, what was so interesting to me is similar to my New Orleans ghost story is that I was so ready to see it that I made it, you know, I almost manifested my own vision, which is the power of television, really. And David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson.
Oh, yeah. And there's no way of knowing if one of those moths might have been Mothman himself.
I mean, who's to say they were regular moths? You know, we don't know that.
They could have been aliens. We don't know. All this to say, I think that this is interesting because when I was reading, I read the ghost book first, and it sort of primed me for this idea of technology and the way we talk about sort of ghosts. And but then I read the UFO book, and it really struck me how similar the language around encounters with ghosts is to the modern language that surrounds encounters with UFOs. And you do a really great job early on in the book sort of tracking that back to how UFOlogy has sort of colonized, you know, old fairy stories and, you know, other ghost stories and tried to find a through line through all of them to sort of argue that aliens have been with us all this time and appearing to us in other forms that are more, you know, more acceptable for their time. And only now have they become sort of technological aliens where, you know, we could accept that because we have airplanes now.
Yes. The philosopher, part psychologist Carl Jung called them technological angels. You know, Carl Jung or Jacques Vallée would say our collective fears took on a technological mask of flying saucers, whereas they had once been angels, fairies, and demons. You know, abduction scenarios have a remarkable similarity to stories about being captured by fairies, you know, being led from the road or being disappeared from a place of comfort like your bed, being led to a strange place where your body and mind are scrutinized by beings with unusual features, and also sometimes being fed strange food.
I think it's interesting that science fiction often is, you know, clearly about anxieties about technology and what it could do, you know. And I'm not saying that ghosts or UFOs don't necessarily exist. It's an unknown. But there are, like you say, there's just interesting parallels between folklore and science fiction and how we've sort of grappled with these in these ideas in a fictional space. Does the UFO phenomenon come from War of the Worlds? Is that like sort of the ground zero in terms of like popular perception of aliens, do you think?
I think that was a huge influence, especially the Orson Welles stunt that he pulled on radio. Good old radio.
Hey!
Speaking of interesting technologies.
Yes. But, you know, we can go as far back as the mystery airship flap around the turn of the century, which was sometime in 1896 in California. There was a big flap of newspapers reporting airships flying everywhere, you know, witnesses coming forward talking about these airships. And, you know, it's tempting to suggest that people were being alarmingly prescient about the future role of aircraft, you know, or the role of aircraft in the coming world, the coming wars. But also, to what extent did the press make it up? A lot of the stories were very tongue-in-cheek, very playful, very ridiculous. I remember one in particular, the airship pilots were revealed to be a naked man and a naked woman who said they were from Mars. Highly strange.
Yeah.
Who's to say they weren't? We don't know.
They could have been naked Martians. Yeah.
Martians famously don't love clothes. I don't know if that's true or not.
I don't think any... Well, actually, it's interesting you say that because I don't think there's ever been a... You know, of all the various alien types that abductees talk about, I don't know that any of them have ever worn clothing that I can think of.
Ah, well, since you mention it, around the 60s, the sort of archetype of alien was often a Nordic-looking person wearing spandex.
Hilarious.
That's right. Like someone out of Star Trek at the time, really, a skin-tight suit, long flowing blonde hair. They had various names attached to them, Nordics, Space Brothers. But there was a period of time when that was the most prominent alien archetype, was this benevolent, blonde, peace-loving space hippie, essentially.
And of course, this has nothing to do with Star Trek, right? This is something that manifests that this Star Trek was obviously a reflection of those aliens and not the other way around, right?
It could be both at the same time, across pollination. But those kind of figures appeared in popular culture and, you know, pulp comics for a long time, you know. And one influences the other, you know, it's a loop, I suppose, a feedback loop.
It is interesting that even then the clothes are form-fitting. It's almost as if in order to be an alien, you have to be in the best shape of your life. or you're not being sent to Earth in any case.
There's often an emphasis on the robotic, on the functional, and then there's the role of technology. In the UFOs, the aliens will use an array of gadgets to scrutinize the people, the abductees. They'll place machinery on their heads. They'll put wires and tubes on them. They'll study them and speak robotically. What does that say? Are we afraid of the machine? Is that how it's manifesting? That's one way of looking at it.
And then it all sort of goes off the rails in the 90s with the X-Files and it tying it. I mean, it had already been tied in, you know, real life conspiracy theories to sort of government black ops and the Roswell crash and secret bad actors and all that. And it just, it manifests, it re-manifests again as sort of a suspicion of government and corporate interests, right?
I think those are the things that we're still afraid of today, as you say, geopolitical instability, some sort of secretive psyop where we're just distrustful. Today, I guess there's the huge push for disclosure within the UFO community. And that's been going on for decades and decades. The need for answers from an official source and the suspicion that they are hiding something from us. But the X-Files really amps that up, that there's that, you know, they're sitting on a craft that crashed somewhere in the desert, or they've got some access to hidden technology. There's a difficult line between healthy skepticism and, you know, off the rails paranoia, I'd say.
Do you think it's metamorphosing now into something else? Do you think aliens maintain their sort of their metaphorical cachet, or are cryptids sort of rising, you know, as our anxieties change?
Cryptids as an American phenomena are like regionalized folkloric figures that you see going back centuries, really. You know, I'm most familiar with where I live, obviously. Where I live, much of the landscape will take its names from stories, you know, stories about the people that lived there once or the creatures that inhabited it. For instance, not too far from where I am now, there's a place called Malham, and there's a waterfall called Janet's Fosset, or Janet's Foss, I think is the correct title. And that was the name of a fairy that supposedly lived there. And that's not dissimilar to now, for instance, in America, where you have places tied quite closely to these regional heroes of Mothman, of these kind of folkloric figures that people will sell merch, or they'll make branded coffee based on them. You know, the full gamut. But it's a character that can tie to a community. They love them in America.
Right. Let's hear it for the Jersey Devil, which is where Stu and I are right now.
Right, nice. Down the road in the old Pine Barrens, yeah.
Do you see much merch in the area for it?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. We have a hockey team.
A whole hockey team. Wow.
A whole hockey team, the New Jersey Devils,
in fact. Yeah.
Ah, of course, there's the connection.
Yeah. I'm sorry, did you say the fairy's name was Janet?
That's right.
Wow. So pedestrian for a fairy.
I know, there's often a J theme with fairies. Janet and Jenny.
Jenny Greenteeth, yeah.
That's right, yeah.
For some reason, Jenny is better to my ear than Janet. I don't know.
Janet sounds like a receptionist, right?
Like she's got an earpiece on. She's here to help you find your way to the room you're looking for, you know? Yeah. Yeah. Not to make fun of any fairies. Please don't.
Yeah, you better not. Janet's Foss is a waterfall, and I believe people used to go there and attempt to see her. She would be bathing there, allegedly. And that was the folkloric draw.
Would she eat you if you saw her?
I imagine that would be an unpleasant end.
So you've done three books on sort of the paranormal, the supernatural. Do you have a sort of unified takeaway about how our perception of the supernatural intersects with our perception of technology?
I guess if you view it through the lens of technological anxiety, you know, you can go back to the 50s and 60s where domestic appliances increased dramatically, namely television. And it's been argued that these cultural symbols became more prominent and because of that, they began to populate our contemporary folklore, you know, or as we call it, urban legends. So you have the mundanity of urban legends about cars and microwaves, all the way up to the more fantastic stories of UFOs. So I guess as technology has become a more prominent fixture of our lives, it simply has it casts a greater shadow on our mind, you know, our collective consciousness, as Carl Jung would put it. These are the symbols that we refer to in our nightmares, in our dreams. We think about sending emails sometimes in our dreams. I've certainly had email dreams. How mad is that?
It's a terrible thing.
Oh, I had one recently, and I haven't worked in corporate America in years at this point. It's truly nightmarish.
So when these things, you know, haunt our conscious and unconscious minds, they become greater symbols to us, whereas centuries ago, our ancestors might have had closer connections to a specific location. You know, that's not to say one is worse or one is better. It's just the reality that we live in. So UFOs, what do they represent? I guess it's a fear of the other. It's a fear of the unknown. It's something that can't be easily quantified. And today it's a crisis if something can't be easily explained. You know, we like to have answers to everything. Or we try and create answers to things. You know, at the extreme end, that would be conspiracies. Or today, most people will probably say that UFOs are a hoax. You know, that's the easy explanation. Whereas the real explanation, I guess, is that it's a mixture of everything. There's a very, 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 very small percentage that, oh, it is actually aliens.
You mentioned this earlier, and I had been thinking about this yesterday when I was sort of preparing for this chat. I studied in one class in school about angel sightings. And so in a time when there wasn't photography or these sort of technological lenses through which to almost both view whatever phenomena and or create it, depending on how you're using it, there's still a lot of people seeing wheels of fire in the sky or strange beings. And I wondered if you had any theories or ideas of why that was, or is it just that we've been using mind-altering substances for our entire existence and we'll hallucinate things at the end of the day?
I guess the most grounded answer is that people see unexplained things all the time. And we try to explain those things through our specific individual and broader social understandings. You know, if someone is greatly interested in religious imagery, they might interpret something as an angel. And that's not to say it isn't an angel, but that might be how they see it. Whereas someone else might see a flying saucer, and someone else might see a ghost, and someone else might see a demon. That would be the sort of Jungian explanation, or the Jacques Vallée idea. You can take that even further and say, well, okay, so this is what some very fringe people would say, would be that there is a phenomena, some sort of extra-dimensional phenomena that is beyond our comprehension, and it deliberately presents itself to us through familiar imagery. And it's trying to tell us something by doing that.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get you to say.
Okay, so that's the John Keel angle. That's the, yeah, Jacques Vallée will go there. You know, that's that there is a literal phenomena rather than just misunderstandings or hallucination.
Or it's, as you say earlier, you know, it's a little bit of everything.
Yes, that's my fence-sitting perspective. It's a bit of everything. Yeah, try not to throw all your eggs in your parapsychological eggs in one basket. You know? I feel I'm pretty grounded on this. I've written on the subject. I've read on the subject. I don't believe too hard in any particular direction. I'm interested by both the skepticism and the belief. You know, I'm not going to join a cult tomorrow, but I do like to think about it. I do like to think about the idea that there are aliens, that there are ghosts.
Well, big thanks to Adam for joining us for this chat about ghosts, UFOs, and everything in between, and technology most of all.
He's so casually interesting and learned. I was really enjoying listening to him expound on the topic. If you liked listening to him, you'll love his books. I was immediately grabbed by his artwork, which, as he mentioned, IKEA instructions as a touchstone, which is very apt because they are very informational. They kind of remind me of the airplane safety.
A little bit, yeah.
There's like a flatness to it, but he manages to imbue them with a lot of humor and a lot of menace in equal measures. And his writing is very informed and informative. So they are, again, an illustrated history of ghosts, UFOs, and urban legends. I almost said
cryptids.
And they're softcover books, editions of ghosts and UFOs under the moniker The Unexplained.
Ghosts, The Unexplained UFOs.
Yeah.
So it's a little confusing, but yeah. they're listed on our show page, Tectonic, Mark's show page, not our show page, yeah. Mark's show page.
Along with a link to his website so you can see more of his art. He does a lot of advertising art that's really great too. Just to shout out the British Library's Tales of the Weird anthology series.
Oh, so good.
They are so good.
They're so good.
They're color-coded. They just have single-color covers with these really evocative ink drawings. I really love them. It's like being in a like supernatural candy store. and they come out monthly, which is bonkers. So there's like 60 or 70 of them at this point. The four Christmas themed ones are Spirits of the Season, Sunless Solstice, Haunters of at the Hearth, and Chill Tidings.
And Chill Tidings. Now I could go for some Chill Tidings.
That's the one I started with.
Yeah.
And then there's also lots of BBC Christmas ghost broadcasts to be found online. They're all on YouTube, really. But there's the A Ghost Story for Christmas series from the 70s. I don't particularly like the newer installments, but they're okay, some of them. Stone Tape is fantastic, as is. I just watched Woman in Black, the original 1989 broadcast, which was on Christmas Eve, and it probably scared the bejesus out of people like who were not expecting like
amazing
this. So good. So check all that stuff out. You will not be sorry. Or maybe you will.
With your recommendations, Stu? Never. You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online all of the time at WFMU.org. Coming up next is It's Complicated with Dave Mandel, so please stay tuned for that. Before I send you off with the best song, one of the best songs in the world, just going to give you this message for the holidays. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. Stu, do you want to tell us a little bit about our song today?
Yeah, so there was a anthology that came out, a compilation or whatever you call it in music, and in 1996 called Songs in the Key of X.
Beautiful.
Which is, recording artists inspired by the X-Files. There's a lot of good tracks on that. Red Right Hand by Nick Cave is on that. Was my first exposure. That CD was just in my player.
That was definitely my first Nick Cave exposure as well.
Yeah, it was just like constant rotation. And we picked...
the best one, the best song.
It is the best song. Unmarked Helicopters by Soul Coughing, which is just, it's so dark and it captures the conspiratorial and the many varied aspects of the intersection of the supernatural and the extraterrestrial and technology.
And in a way, it's a little Christmassy.
Yeah.
So happy holidays, everyone. See you next time. Ooh.
Whose song is that remembered? At random serpenting through fatty coils emerging. Some other thought it's thinking. This light shines above the houses on the ground. This illumination visited upon the whole land. Unmarked helicopters hovering. The Lord is coming soon. Here comes the supercopter, here comes the noise it makes. The demon was an idea, the demon is awake. Well, scratch mark left across the surface of your mind. This hour now upon us, the hour has now arrived. Unmarked helicopters hovering. The Lord is coming soon.
And good evening, and welcome to another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I bring this show into your living room, or wherever you happen to be, every Monday evening at 7 p.m. And lots of good music for you tonight, believe it or not. I'm going to start with something from a French band. This is kind of a like a holy grail. Or was a holy grail, a French single released in 1976 that is, of course, now very rare. I do not own a copy. I hasten, eager to get that information out there because I'm not, you know, holding this over your head. The record's been made available on Bandcamp, which is really good, so you can find it there. The group is called Ankh, A-N-K-H, you know, like the symbol, Ankh. And again, it's a single released in 76. Really interesting record that I'd call maybe like fuzz prog. It's kind of a combination of genres. It's got some hints of Canterbury, maybe, and some surprisingly garage fuzz guitar. So this is the group Ankh. And again, that's the group Ankh, A-N-K-H, like the symbol that a lot of hippies used to wear around their neck, medallion that a lot of hippies used to wear around their neck. And again, a single from 76, Les Maîtres du Temps, the Masters of the Time, would be the more or less English translation. And one of these well-known, well-sought-after French rarities that now is available for everyone, for you and me, on Bandcamp, group Ankh. Let's stick with the mid-70s just a little bit longer. I'm going to play something. This is a group that I've been meaning to play for a while, and I just keep not getting to it. They're called Crack the Sky. They're American. I believe they were from West Virginia, and they were this kind of interesting kind of sound of the time. I would call sort of prog pop or pop prog, sort of in the vein of, like Supertramp or